We're pleased to welcome to the program a music legend. Along with Gordon Waller, he racked up 10 top 40 hits in the 1960s. As Peter and Gordon went on to become one of the most respected and successful music producers and managers in the business, hosts a terrific show these days on the Beatles Channel on Sirius XM Radio. We're thrilled to be joined this afternoon by Peter Asher. Peter, thank you so much for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Very happy to be here. Goodness me, I mean, you mentioned my show on XM. I'm coming up to my 100th show, which feels like a lot. And you said this is what, close to your 2000th?
It is, but I talk really fast, so it goes by quickly.
Well, I'm impressed. I've thought enough, having done 100. Well done.
You also just got back from, let me see if I get it right here, the Rock and Romance Cruise, right?
Yes. It was actually interesting because I did 3 cruises in a row, oddly enough. Two were work and one was recreation, because I did the Flower Power cruise, which is a 60s cruise, for a week. Then I did, as you say, the Rock and Romance, which is a 70s flavored cruise, for a week. So I had, you know, the first half was more Peter and Gordon oriented, second half oriented towards the next leg of my career, which was, you know, James Taylor and Linda Ronstadt and all that kind of stuff. And then, oddly enough, it coincided exactly with a plan my wife and I had made a couple of years ago to go and do the Galapagos Islands, which is astounding and amazing, and I could talk about forever. And that, of course, was not working. The Galapagos penguins had no interest in hearing World Without Love, so we were there to see them. But it was, so I did 3 cruises in a row.
Well, I want to go back to the beginning of your career, because people here in the States may not realize, we talk about the British invasion, and Peter and Gordon were among that very first wave to have hits here, but what's astounding is to realize how many incredibly successful British acts there were, from everybody from Cliff Richard, Lonnie Donegan, and others, who had tried to have success here in America but didn't until the Beatles kicked that door open for so many groups.
That's exactly true. I mean, well, actually, you mentioned Lonnie Donegan. He's the one of the very few that did. I mean, Rock Island Line was kind of a hit in America. So he was one who broke through. And I think the other one, probably one of the biggest ones, weirdly, was Acca Bilk, if you remember.
Stranger on the Shore. Yeah, of course.
Huge hit. But certainly our biggest stars, Cliff Richard, Tommy Steele, you know, Marty Wilde, all the English rockers, Billy Fury, people who preceded the Beatles, had no success in America whatsoever. Cliff had a bit of modest success later on, but compared to the UK and the rest of the world, actually, Australia, even Canada, you know, what one used to be able to describe as the British Empire, but he was a huge star, but never in America. You're absolutely right. The Beatles broke the door down, and the rest of us followed them through gladly. But I always say that, you know, the British invasion was kind of 90% the Beatles and 10% all the rest of us who got lucky. But we were indeed we immediately followed the Beatles. The first number one of the British invasion after the Beatles, after I Want to Hold Your Hand was number one, the next British invasion-flavored number one was indeed World Without Love, which, of course, didn't worry them at all since Paul wrote it. So well, it was really continuing their reign at the top.
You had a little advantage there, too, because Paul was dating your sister Jane, actually living in your house for a while there. Nice to have that songwriting talent in the house. But I'm fascinated. You've been friends with Paul now for more than 50 years. I've never met or interviewed Paul, but it seems to me, for a guy who has had experiences and successes that most of us can't possibly imagine, he seems to have stayed pretty grounded through the years. How is that possible?
I think so. I mean, it's almost deliberate on his part. He tries to remain sort of one of the guys. And of course, it's impossible because he isn't. You know, like, at a certain point, you have to go to face it. You know, you are different. You're insanely famous. You're a genius musically. And you're one of the most highly respected musicians of the century. But he has found a way to deal with that. No question. I mean, I don't see a lot of Paul, but we see each other from time to time. And he does indeed manage to maintain a balance between the necessity of living differently because, you know, you're so instantly recognizable and famous and everybody wants to say hello, and at the same time remaining a pretty normal chap, which he has.
You were part of an incredible London music scene in the 1960s. Could you relate the story of the time you got to see the Jimi Hendrix Experience Am I correct, from the Royal Box?
Yes, you are correct. The story was this. Jimi Hendrix had been around, you know, and he'd showed up in London. Some of us had seen him. He'd sat in a couple of clubs, like the Scotch of St. James and what was the other one called? Can't remember now. It'll come back to me. A couple of places where people would sit in. And we were aware of his astounding guitar skills, vaguely. But then he kind of disappeared for a bit while he put together the band, working with Chas Chandler, who is his manager, who you might know is the bass player in the Animals. Mm. He was a big Jimmy proponent and was managing him, and they put together the Experience with Mitch and Noel. And then the premiere of that band was as part of a show at the Savile Theatre. Savile was a theatre in London that Brian Epstein had leased to put on shows. He wanted to promote some rock and roll shows. So he started doing shows at the Savile. I think it was once a week or something. And one of those shows was the premiere of the Jimi Hendrix Experience. There were several other acts on the show, including Denny Lane and his string band, which was a terrific band that Denny Lane had put together. That might have been when Paul and Denny first met, I don't know. After Denny, of course, was in the Yardbirds. Anyway, Brian Epstein was, as it were, the theatre owner, and every theatre in London has a Royal Box, which is provisionally available to the Queen and members of the Royal Family should they wish to attend. But since the Queen, inexplicably, had not made a request to attend the premiere of the Jimi Hendrix Experience, I'm sure she's sorry she missed it, but that meant that the theatre bought the Royal Box was for the use of the owner of the theatre, Brian Epstein. So thus it was that I ended up with a couple of Beatles sitting in the Royal Box, watching for the very first time Jimi Hendrix do the full Jimi Hendrix Experience stuff, and, you know, the setting fire to his guitar and playing with his teeth and all that stuff. And not only that, but as is mentioned in some of the history books, Jimmy had heard Sergeant Pepper, the song, a couple of days earlier on the radio. It was just out. The Beatles had just released it. And had learned it off the radio.
That's right, yeah.
And taught it to his band that afternoon and opened the show with it.
Wow.
So not only was the whole thing magical and extraordinary, but to the Beatles' amazement, I can't remember, to be honest. I think it's in the book somewhere, but I think it was three Beatles out of four, and maybe John wasn't there. I can't remember. Sorry. But I do remember Paul being stunned and amazed that not only was Jimi Hendrix extraordinary, but he opened the show playing a brand new Beatles song, note for note, and it was breathtaking.
We're talking with Peter Asher here on Downtown. Even with the success as a recording artist, you knew pretty early on that you wanted to be a producer. What was it about that role that interested you?
I thought it was fantastic. I mean, once I figured out what a producer did, you know, when Gordon and I first got in the studio, and you have to remember, it's such a different era. Now, you know, you can make records easily on a laptop and in your bedroom or whatever. But back then, until you got into a real studio with real musicians, there was no chance of making anything resembling a real record. And so, you know, when we got our record deal, which is a separate story, but there we were at Abbey Road Studios. Well, EMI Studios it was then. Then changed the name at that point. Abbey Road was just the address, not the name. And there we were, and I kind of went, this is incredibly cool. I love the technology of it. The idea that the producer could try out ideas and have arrangement ideas, of which I had many, and, you know, hire musicians much better than oneself and tell them what to do. I thought that was extraordinary and wonderful, and I still do it to this day. So I did decide, you're absolutely right, quite early on, that being a record producer was something I wanted to do. It was a career ambition. Becoming a manager was entirely separate. That was never an ambition of mine and was predicated on a whole other series of events. But production was something I definitely had my eye and ear on from the moment I stepped into the studio.
You produced James Taylor's first album through Apple Records. It was not a commercial success, but you believed in him so much, though, that you left Apple behind and moved to America and then produced that incredible string of albums that he did in the 1970s. What made you believe so much in James Taylor?
It's like, what's not to believe in? I mean, first time he came to my flat, you may know we were introduced to each other long distance by a guitar player called Danny Korchmar, wonderful player, great friend of mine. He'd accompanied Peter and Gordon. We'd become friends. And he was subsequently in a band called The Flying Machine with his childhood friend, James Taylor. When that band broke up, James gave him my phone number because James was headed to London. So James called me out of the blue in London, said, I'm, you know, Danny's friend. And I said, oh, great, you know, come over. And he came over the next day, next evening, played me a tape that he'd cut. And, you know, the songs were amazing. The guitar playing was amazing. He'd clearly been listening to Segovia and Julian Bream and great classical players because he played with that kind of precision and accuracy. Plus, he wasn't playing classical chords or folk chords. He was playing almost jazzy chords, kind of chords from all this listening to, you know, Manhattan's records and that kind of thing. And so I loved all of that. I loved his voice. It was a beautiful, folky voice, but wasn't singing folky licks. He was singing, he was clearly owing more to Sam Cooke and Ray Charles than he was to, you know, Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie. So all that appealed to me. And then on top of it, finally, of course, these extraordinary songs. That first time he played for me at my flat, he played Something in the Way She Moves and Something's Wrong and Knocking Around the Zoo. And, you know, I was blown away. And that's when this peculiar conversation ensued because, as it happened, I just got this new job as head of A&R for Apple Records. And I said to James, look, I'm working for this new record label. I can sign people, you know, would you like a record deal? And he said, yes, please, I'd love one. That was pretty much it. It was that simple. And I took him into Apple a few days later to meet the board of directors, which is to say the Beatles.
You had an incredible run of success as well with Linda Ronstadt. And my goodness, the list of tremendous albums that she did in the 70s, Heart Like a Wheel, Simple Dreams, Hasten Down the Wind. I know she's been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but I still don't feel like she's been given her due enough. Is there a
Linda's
better singer?
That stuff. Linda doesn't, you know, she didn't even mind about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and I kept saying, you should be in there, you know. She's very good and genuinely replies, you know, that's not why I sang. It wasn't for that kind of stuff. Yes, absolutely. Linda cannot be overrated. She's breathtakingly good. She's the finest singer I ever worked with. And the James Keach, you know, the actor, produced a brand new documentary about Linda that I haven't even seen yet. They just premiered it two nights ago at the Tribeca Film Festival. Got rave reviews. I did a lengthy interview for it, so but I haven't seen even my bit, so I don't know. But the documentary is apparently fabulous, and I'm not sure how or when it's actually coming out. I'm getting a copy to watch next week. But she is the best thing I've ever worked with in my life.
We're talking with Peter Asher on Downtown. You came up in the tape days, the two-track and then the four-track days, but I understand that you love digital recording. You're not a guy who looks back at the good old days of tape.
That's correct. You're very well informed. I don't. I mean, I get people saying to me, oh, you're so lucky you grew up with tape. And I'm so happy to see the back of it. You know, they don't talk about now the, you know, tones and azimuth and CCIR and NAB equalization, and then let alone the fact that, you know, you carry around big heavy rolls of tape with you everywhere you go. You couldn't, you know, you had to look, watch out for it, and if you made a copy, it didn't sound nearly as good as the original tape. So there were nightmares associated with tape. And admittedly, when digital started, it had disadvantages all of its own. It didn't sound really good. It took them a while to get it together. Initially, I was agreed with the people who said it sounds a bit too crispy and thin and inhumanly, you know, or inhumanly bright. But they eventually got converters organized that really sounded good and upped the standards so you could do it, you know, 96K and stuff. And I'm not yet technical, but digital now sounds good, and it is so much more convenient. All the things you can do now were things we wished we could do back in the day. You know, you'd have a couple of notes, a great take with a couple of bad notes in it. And you wish you could just tune those two notes and make them fit. And, you know, the kick and the kick drum and the bass weren't together on that one beat, but it was such a great take. Now you can fix all that, and I love to. It can be overdone, of course. Things can be, again, fixed to an inhuman degree. But the ability to correct mistakes that we've all wished we had back in the day, now we do, and it's fabulous.
Do you have any upcoming shows? I know you've been doing shows occasionally with Jeremy Clyde of Chad and Jeremy. More of those on the docket for you?
Yes, I've got a few more Peter and Jeremy shows. I've got some of my memoir show, which is the one I do on my own with a whole bunch of video and stuff. I don't know them all in my head, even though I should, but there's a website, peterashermusic.com, that has all the up-to-date itinerary and upcoming shows on it. I should be well equipped with a piece of paper and plugging myself like crazy, but the truth is I look about a week ahead in the calendar, make sure I know what I'm doing today and move on.
Well, and
there are some coming, I know that.
The Sirius XM show, From Me to You, it airs Thursday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, and then you can hear it again Saturday at 5, Sunday at 8 a.m., Tuesdays at 1 p.m. An absolutely wonderful show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much. It's fun to do. I mean, it's hard work, as you well know, because each week, you know, I'm faced with a blank piece of paper, and, you know, now what am I going to do and talk about? Because, of course, I end up playing a lot of the same songs again and again, and because it all has to be Beatle or Beatle-related or, you know, Beatle influences and that kind of thing. But, sometimes I do get intimidated when it's drawing near. And each time I go away, of course, like doing these three cruises, I have to make sure they're stocked up with a few shows before I go. And as I come back, I'm going, oh, God, you know, the supply has nearly run out. I have to get back into the factory. In fact, that's where I'm going this afternoon, is to record another couple of shows that I wrote over the weekend.
Well, Peter, I've enjoyed your work for many years with all the various hats that you've worn. It's a real treat for us to have the opportunity to talk with you today.
It's been a great pleasure, and thank you very much. You clearly did a bit of homework. You had a lot of information already, and it's a joy talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I hope we talk with you again sometime down the road.
Anytime.
Great. Thank you, Peter.
Just give me a call.
That's Peter Asher here on Downtown. Again, check out the show on the Beatles channel, Sirius XM, Thursdays at 8 p.m. From Me to You with Peter Asher.